This podcast delves into the dark, the depraved, and all things to keep you up at night. Listener discretion is advised. Now, sit back, pull the covers over your head, and allow yourself to be taken on a journey through the abyss.
Grips the heart of London, terror out of sight, plots his next victim, a lady of the night. Mary Jane Kelly, a Whitechapel whore, is in her small apartment while Jack looks to score. He leaves his streets empty. This shall be his biggest thrill. Undetected he enters, for Kelly fits the bill. His fury grows most brutal. He slams her to the bed. His slashes have no limit now. He will make sure she's dead. Precisely dicing her up, he holds back not a bit, and showing her no mercy, he makes a mess of it. He slips back to the shadows, a phantom in the night. He left her body ravished, a truly gruesome sight. Then, like an apparition, he disappears unseen. The most notorious killer that there has ever been.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Through the Abyss podcast. I am Ben.
And I'm Mandy.
And today we will be looking at the life and death of Mary Jane Kelly.
Quite a gruesome one. This is by far his worst one yet. So we forgive the phrase, save the best for last.
Yes, possibly his last victim. I say possibly because depending on what theory you go with, he either stops abruptly, moves, doesn't stop at all.
Or he's H.H. Holmes and just takes his stuff back to the United States.
Yes, very possible. He jumped on a boat. Montague Druitt committed suicide around that time. So it's like lots of theories.
We will be going over probably next week, maybe. Because like I said, I'm not sure how many episodes we're going to get out of this, Jack. Because this is our last victim one. So we're going to be jumping into the meat and potatoes next week. So I have a feeling we may be going
a very fun time.
Several, yeah. And that's all Mr. Ben. He's going to be presenting his Jack facts.
Unless it becomes like 12 episodes, then I have to bounce some back to you. Because, like, really, there is just so much, right? I want to go over for sure the most popular and most possibly in that regard legit suspects, right? But then some of the conspiracy theories are very interesting, right? Mm-hmm. The Dear Boss letters, whether they're legit or not, are definitely something to look at. The diary of Jack the Ripper, whether it's real or not, something that very much needs to be looked at. And there's just a lot.
Yeah, there really, really is. It's so weird that, I don't know, I guess it's just because it's like one of the first and it's unsolved and we'll never really know, I don't think, who actually did it. But, you know, five victims, that's not a what I would call a prolific serial killer, but he seems to stay in the hearts of all true crime listeners. Right.
But again, unless he's at H.H. Holmes and he moved.
For real.
Right? I mean, that very is super true. Prolific.
Yeah, so, if it turns out that he is H.H. Holmes, he is probably the most prolific.
Yes.
If, you know, everything H.H. Holmes did was actually true. But, you know, we'll get into that next time because he's going to be the next one we're diving into. All right, shall we get into Mary Jane Kelly?
Sounds good.
Okay, so Mary Jane Kelly was approximately 25 years old at the time of her death, which would place her birth around 1863. She was 5'7", tall and stout. So 5'7", again, that's for her, for that age, is pretty tall, kind of like Liz. She had blonde hair, blue eyes, and a fair complexion. Now, almost everything that we know about her comes from Joseph Barnett, who lived with her just prior to the murder. And he, of course, had all his information from Kelly herself. So this is kind of secondhand knowledge from the original source, I guess you could call it. Some is conflicting, maybe suspected that some or perhaps much of it is embellished. So she might have said a lot of stuff to this Joseph Barnett guy that may have been partially true, but, you know, kind of spiked up a little bit. Like, you know, we do at times. Sometimes. I do a lot. Anyway, she was born in Limerick, Ireland, but we don't know if that refers to the county or the town. And as a young child, she moved with the family to Wales. So again, as another one's kind of moved around a little bit. Her father was John Kelly, who worked in an ironworks. Mary Jane claims to have 6 or 7 brothers and 1 sister. She says that one brother, Henry, whose nickname is Jonto, what a cool nickname like that, is a member of the 2nd Battalion Scots Guards. As a member of this...
I'm sorry, but I just like that she has 6 or 7 brothers. It's like she can't remember. It's like, I don't know, they popped out a lot. I'm thinking 6 range, maybe 7.
Well, yeah, but I mean, if it's coming from John Kelly, maybe he didn't remember how many she said.
Yeah.
Possibly.
Possibly.
So John Kelly, it's a name we're all familiar with, yes?
Yes, yes.
We remember last week we talked about Kate or Catherine Eddowes living with him. If this is indeed the same person, I actually did a little bit of research on that. And
this is turns Mary Jane's father.
Yeah. But okay. John Kelly apparently was a very, very common name back then, kind of like Michael Smith would be now, that type of thing. So perhaps different men. I mean, if it was her father, I would think, I can't imagine her doing all this stuff with daddy around, you know, that would just be kind of weird. But then again, I don't know, maybe he was like her pimp. I don't know. So, but similar names, could be the same guy, might not be, don't know. It's a big mystery.
Pimping out his daughter, pimping out his girl, pimping out everybody.
Oh yeah. That's, I think old Mary Jane liked to talk a little bit, because she also claimed that she had a relative on the London stage, which, from what I understand, was a pretty prestigious job back then, I think, anyway. Now, John McCarthy, landlord at Miller's Court, states that she received a letter from her mother in Ireland. Barnett says that she never corresponded with her family. Okay, well, that kind of throws that John Kelly out a little bit. So maybe there's 2 different John Kellys. Joseph Barnett and Mrs. Carthy, which was a landlady from Breezers Hill. She'd lived with her at one time. Said that she came from a family that was fairly well off and they were well-to-do people. Mrs. Carthy also states that Kelly was an excellent scholar and an artist of no mean degree. What does that mean? No mean degree.
I mean,
is that a compliment
the first thing I thought is I'm not quite sure what the wording means. I mean, context clue, I would say that it means that like she's unparalleled, like she's a very good artist, but yeah. I've never seen that phrasing before.
And this is the first time I've heard of any of these victims as being an excellent scholar. So, well, I mean, if she truly well to do, then I suppose she would have good upbringing as far as school. Goes.
Said Ed Eddowes was a good scholar as well.
Catherine was?
The last one. Yep. Hmm. He said she had gone to school, and then one of the people that was interviewed said she was a good scholar.
Well, then perhaps they did know each other. Maybe they did run in the same circles.
Yeah.
Which wouldn't be too hard to imagine, given the size of the area that they frequented.
Right.
All right. Now, this is circa 1879-ish. At the age of 16, she marries a collier named Davies. He's killed in an explosion 2 or 3 years later, and there's suggestion that there might have been a child in this marriage. So she could have a kid, she might not, we don't know. Kelly moves to Cardiff and lives with a cousin and works as a prostitute. The Cardiff police have no record of her. She says she was ill and spent the best part of her time in an infirmary.
I feel like prostitution back then was so rampant that it was just a job choice, it feels like, right? Because, I mean, like, they're saying she's a little better off to do. She's, like, got this education. And she just moves to Cardiff, and she's like, well, now I'm going to prostitute. It's just a job decision.
It may be. I mean, it's, you know, it's obviously legal.
Yeah.
Even though she didn't register stuff, which I'm sure would probably be seen as maybe illegal, but...
Right. I mean, like in today's society, right? We obviously feel like you become a prostitute, you've hit a lot of bad turns, right?
Right.
Here, it's just like, feels like, it's like, I could become a secretary. I could go work at a house. Why don't I prostitute on the weekends? Right. Like, it's just like an extra job.
Maybe it was. Maybe it's, you know, if she did have the scholarly background, I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe it was that, you know, it's kind of the poor part of town, but I mean, she could have always moved, I guess.
Right.
I don't, perhaps there weren't any jobs available for women.
Yeah, maybe. But like I say, whether it's a job choice or it is because unfortunate events happen and now she's hard up, it definitely puts you in a dangerous position, right? Because you've got to be out in the bad parts of the town, like you said, at night. And
so. Yeah, that's something that certainly has not changed from the 1800s to now. It's still a very dangerous profession. Probably even more so now.
Yeah.
All right, so now it's 1884 and she is now in London. She may have stayed with the nuns at the Providence Row Night Refuge on Crispin Street. According to one tradition, she scrubbed floors and charred here and was eventually placed into domestic service in a shop in Cleveland Street. Okay, so she had a job. Perhaps she didn't like scrubbing. Perhaps prostitution was more fun, I guess. Yeah. For lack of a better way of putting it, I don't know.
And then I'm wondering about, you know, the possibly staying with the nuns. Like, did they know what she was doing? If so, it makes me like, go nuns, right? Because Christians shouldn't be judgmental people. But I feel like today the nuns would turn her away. So it's kind of cool that back then they're like, you can stay here.
Well, I mean, maybe it wasn't so... What's the word I'm looking for? Not an enigma, but
didn't have the
stigmatized.
It didn't
have so much stigma attached to it.
But nuns, right? Nuns are all about not having premarital sex.
Well, yeah. I mean, you talk about Catholicism. Yeah, that's a thing. But I mean, it's a profession. So maybe they draw the line at, you know, she's working. She's contributing to society.
It doesn't really count. It doesn't count because it's I don't know. I don't know.
I figure they would probably be a lot more strict back then than they would be today. But
right,
maybe they didn't actually know that she went out at night.
Right.
For that reason.
I mean, clearly there's still some sort of stigma attached to it, or it wouldn't all be clumped in this bad neighborhood, right? Where people are getting murdered. They would be in like ritzier areas trying to get some higher clientele. So I figure at least for the John's sake, you know, it's kind of got a stigma.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. It's a shame. All right. According to Joseph Barnett, on arriving in London, Kelly went to work in a high-class brothel in the West End. Hey, weren't we just talking about that?
Yes.
So I guess they did have high-class brothels, which makes sense since it's legal. So
right.
Why are these women going to the worst part of town?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, I mean... It could be what they look like, right? Maybe she's able to go to the higher end. She's younger, prettier.
Yeah.
Not to judge the victims or whatever, but like I said, like it's hard to tell from the photos, but in today's beauty standards, to me, not a big group of lookers.
Well, you know, they had a hard life. Cut them some slack.
They did. I mean, But yeah, I think it would be the same thing as like you go to a strip club in a bad part of town versus a strip club in like a more populated area. You're going to have a very different stripper.
I've and not never that actually been strip to a strip clubs, club,
but if you did, there's definitely quality rankings.
Oh my God, that's awful, but still kind of funny at the same time. Sorry, ladies. Everybody is beautiful, Ben.
That's true.
All right, now, so the West End, she was in a brothel. I wonder if they ended up in that part of town because they, well, most of them were alcoholics, and that may not have been the proper thing to do in the upper part of the class.
Yeah, it could have. I mean, it's probably the bar district, right? The red light district. All the bars.
Well, definitely the red light district, that's for sure. Right.
So if you're going to prostitute and you have an alcohol problem, you're going to prostitute near where all the bars are?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Now, while she was in that nice brothel, she says that during this time, she frequently rode in a carriage and accompanied one gentleman to Paris, which she didn't like, and she returned. Wow, she didn't like Paris. Okay. But she likes Whitechapel. I've never been to Whitechapel, but I have been to Paris, and she has interesting tastes. I'll just put it that way.
Well, I mean, we've discussed it before, because I don't want to keep sounding like we're destroying Whitechapel. Like you said, it's a much nicer, cool place. Yes. Now Whitechapel is probably awesome. I don't know if it's Paris awesome.
I'm going to say probably not, but I've never been there.
But back then, definitely Paris.
So if you live in Whitechapel now, I would love to we would love to hear from you and tell us, you know, what it's really like now. And if you've gotten past that stigma of that's where all Jack the Ripper's whores live, you know, I'm just curious. Anybody who's listening, even if you don't live there, if you've ever been there, that's fine too.
Works.
Now, on November 10th, one day after the murder, Mrs. Elizabeth Phoenix, went to the Lehman Street police station and said that a woman matching the description of Kelly used to live in her brother-in-law's house in Breezer's Hill. And Breezer's Hill was where Mrs. McCarthy was. She's one of the people who gave depositions and all that fun stuff. Mrs. Phoenix says that she was Welsh and that her parents, who had discarded her, still lived in Cardiff from where she came from. But on occasion, she declared that she was Irish. She added that Mary Jane was very abusive and quarrelsome when she was drunk, but one of the most decent and nice girls you can meet when sober. Wow.
We're seeing some stuff here, right? Like, so her life kind of did turn. If this stuff is true, right? Her parents have kind of abandoned her. So she doesn't have the funds anymore that she had grown up with.
Right.
And then we're falling into the alcohol issues that we discuss with pretty much every victim.
Oh, poor Mary. 1886, again, this is circa-ish, so not all the dates are conclusive, but Kelly leaves Carthy's house to live with a man in the building trades. By 1886, she's living in Cooley's lodging house in Thaw Street, and it's here that she meets Joseph Barnett. Okay, so this is where Barnett comes back into play, where a lot of the information about her originated. Joseph Barnett is London-born of Irish heritage. He's a riverside laborer and market porter who's licensed to work at Billingsgate Fish Market. He comes from a family of three sisters and one brother who's named Daniel. Barnett was born in 1858 and dies in 1926. Wow, he actually lived a long time for that time period.
Yeah.
Julia Venturni says that Joe Barnett is of good character and was kind to Mary Jane, giving her money on occasion. Barnett and Kelly are remembered as a friendly and pleasant couple who give little trouble unless they're drunk. Okay, so bad drunkers again. She may be the Mary Jane Kelly who was fined. Here's that 2/6. So I have no idea what that really is.
Oh, the money unit?
Yeah, the money thing. She was fined some amount by the Thames Magistrate Court on September 19th, 1888 for being drunk and disorderly.
Oh, Lord.
That seems to happen a lot, right?
Yeah, and it's just like, I mean, everything's hindsight, and it's easy for me to say as a person who hardly ever drinks, but if everyone's describing you as being this great person, except when you're drinking, and the end of every sentence is except when you're drinking, you would think maybe you'd be like, I might not want to be a drinker.
Yeah, unless, you know, she just didn't care.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm nice most of the time.
Right. And we've just obviously her life has taken some turns. I would think that it would be really, really hard to prostitute without being drunk.
In that day and age, yeah, because, you know, hygiene was not a huge thing. So I can't even begin to imagine that.
Yeah.
Especially some of the things that they were paid to do. Mm-mm. No, thank you. I will certainly. I'll certainly pass on that.
It's like, it blows my mind, especially with the Jack the Ripper crimes. Obviously, like, those women didn't get paid. They got murdered, right? It's like, back in this place, it just seems like half of these people probably don't even end up getting paid. You know what I'm saying? Like, they probably get like knocked around and then it's like, nope, not paying. Like, I could be wrong, but it like feels like it's almost a crapshoot whether or not you're even getting the money.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible because thievery and everything was rampant in this area. But I mean, I would assume that they got the money up front before providing any services. But, you know, like you said, they could have been knocked around. But I mean, at the same time, I don't know, maybe they were fairly tough and could fend off. I mean, okay, you would know about this more than I would, but I mean, aren't you generally a little bit tired and maybe not all together after you've blown your load?
So oh, Lord.
Maybe they could get away.
I didn't know that's where the sentence was turning. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I wouldn't be looking for a fight.
Ben's face is turning red at this very moment.
Probably, yeah.
Well, I mean, come on. It's one explanation for maybe how they could fend off certain people.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's fair. It's just like, seems like such a violent place. It's like you got the leather apron guy, right, going around trying to steal people's money anyways. Anyways, it's like, man, like how these women like survived this. It's like, well, and some didn't, but like, it's just mind-boggling that like you're going out there, you're dealing with Jack the Ripper's out there killing people, mm-hmm. Leather apron, assuming he's not Jack the Ripper, which I think they pretty much established, is beating up and robbing you, right? Yeah. And then you've got your regular clients who could be good, they could be bad. You don't know what they're gonna do.
Then and you're drunk on like, top of it.
You're drunk, and then there's just random people killing people too, because everyone's got a knife apparently during this time period
or something. Big rock or something.
It's just horrible. It's like, I don't know how they dealt with any of this and having to like do this just to pay for a bed.
Oh yeah,
like we discussed last week, it's like you're not paying your rent in your apartment, you're not paying your mortgage at your home, you're paying for one bed for one night, and then tomorrow you have to do it again. Horrible.
Maybe several times because you keep drinking your money away.
Yes, it's just like, oh my God, I don't like, this is what I'm trying to display here. I'm stressed out thinking about being them. Like I'm being like, my empathy has traveled back to 1880 whatever to where it's like, I couldn't have done this.
Oh no, absolutely not. There's no way in hell I would.
Even for Thames. Mary Jane Kelly, they say she just like some of the other ones, when she's not drinking, she's a happy person.
Maybe, I mean, like it's, we've said several times, maybe it's just that time period, you know, there's no better way for these people and they're just accepting their fates for
a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, wow. What else can they do? Right.
Sorry. I mean, I didn't mean to get off on the tangent. It's just, I just like, it really stresses me out thinking about when we get to the part where every one of them is like heading out at night, etc. I mean, obviously she's not going to be on the street for her final, but anyways, you know what I'm saying. Anyway,
I got you.
Carry on.
All right. So Good Friday, April 8th, 1887. Joseph Barnett meets Mary Jane Kelly for the first time, and he takes her for a drink and arranges to meet her the following day. At their second meeting, they arrange to live together. These people move fast. Wow.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, I can't even get a date, and my second date is never moving in.
Oh, I was going to say something, but I'll be nice. Never mind. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, they waste no time. Lord have mercy. So they take lodgings in George Street, which is off of Commercial Street. And later they move to Little Paternoster Row off Dorset Street. So they're still in the same area. They're evicted for not paying rent and for being drunk. All right. So here's the drunkenness again. In February or March of 1888, they move from Brick Lane to Miller's Court. Here they occupy
I got to throw in one more thing about my stress. Because when you said they get kicked out for not paying the rent and for being drunk, I'm like, think about all the money all these people would have if they didn't buy alcohol every day.
Yeah, they actually probably could afford like their own place.
They could move out of the scary town.
Right. Well, I don't know. because of who they are, maybe the upper class wouldn't accept them.
Yeah, it's possible.
And would chase them out. August or early September 1888, Barnett loses his job and Mary Jane returns to the streets. Barnett decides to leave her. Well, now, how's that for?
Ow.
She's going to go to work to support his ass, and he's, what a dick.
Yeah.
That's harsh. She better not take him back. Okay, and then here's another. October 30th, between 5 and 6 p.m., Elizabeth Prater, who lives above Kelly, reports that Barnett and Kelly have an argument, and Barnett leaves her. He goes to live at Buller's boarding house. Barnett states at the inquest that he left her because she was allowing other prostitutes to stay in the room. She would never have gone wrong again, he tells a newspaper, and I shouldn't have left her if it had not been for the prostitutes stopping at the house. She only let them stay there because she was good-hearted and did not like to refuse them shelter on cold, bitter nights. He adds, we lived comfortably until Maria allowed a prostitute named Julia to sleep in the same room. I objected, and as Mrs. Harvey afterwards came and stayed there, I left and took lodgings elsewhere.
Got herself a rare guy here, by the way, that's like, oh, too many naked chicks showing up in my room. Can't,
right?
Can't have that happening.
I was thinking the same thing.
Like, what, 8 prostitutes instead of 1? That sounds horrible. Don't want it.
And 2 women in my bed at the same time? No, thank you. No,
she tried to sleep in the same room with us.
Yeah, I think there's something wrong with this guy. Maria, well, unless they were ugly, like you said, then.
Possible. You know. But I think back then, I feel like back then, no one was.
Well, you know what? You're probably right.
They're all beautiful.
You're probably right. Maria Harvey stayed with Kelly on the nights of November 5th and 6th. She moved to new lodgings at 3 New Court, another alley off Dorset Street. So again, still in the same vicinity. Wednesday, November 7th, Mary Jane buys a halfpenny candle from McCarthy's shop. All right, so Wednesday, November 7th, Mary Jane buys a halfpenny candle from McCarthy's shop. She's later seen in Miller's Court by Thomas Bowyer, a pension soldier whose nickname is Indian Harry. He's employed by McCarthy and lives at 37 Dorset Street. Bowyer states that on Wednesday night, he saw a man speaking to Kelly who closely resembled the description of the man Matthew Packer claims to have seen with Elizabeth Stride. His appearance was smart and attention was drawn to him by his very white cuffs and rather long white collar, which came down over the front of his long black coat. He did not carry a bag.
Interesting. Because like in some of the past descriptions of Jack, right, they've said that he was kind of sophisticated, but in a, or genteel, but in a kind of scruffy way, right?
Where, yeah.
Like, this sounds like someone who's got a little bit of money to him.
Yeah, and no mention of a hat either.
Yeah.
And he didn't have his murder bag.
Yeah, but it's probably not the time for the murder, right? So you wouldn't,
true.
You wouldn't wear the nice white cuffs on the day you're doing the murder.
Oh, no, there's no way in hell he'd be able to get away with that one without having blood get on his cuffs. Almost every day after the split, Barnett would visit Mary Jane. On Friday the 9th, he stops between 7:30 and 7:45 p.m. He says that she's in the company of another woman who lives in Miller's Court, and this may have been Lizzie Albrook. Albrook says, about the last thing she said to me was, whatever you do, don't do wrong and turn out as I did. Aw, that's sad. She often had spoken to me in this way and warned me against going on the street as she had done. She told me, too, that she was heartily sick of the life she was leading and wished she had money enough to go back to Ireland where her people lived. I don't believe she would have gone out as she did if she had not been obliged to do so to keep herself from starvation.
That explains that, huh?
Wow. So she hated her. That's it. Well,
very, very sad.
There's your alcohol reason. She hates her life.
Yeah, that's what I said too. Yeah, that explains exactly. Yeah, you'd have to drink constantly because you hate your life.
Can't even imagine. All right, so now we are unfortunately down to the murder timeline. And if I haven't said this before as we started, this is a very gruesome kill. I mean, all of them were, but this even more so. So again, we'll be going over those details. So if you can't stomach those, you might want to fast forward through the end of it. But it's a pretty gruesome one. Murder timeline. Thursday through Friday, November 8th through the 9th. At 8 p.m., Barnett leaves and goes back to Buller's boarding house where he played whist until 12:30 a.m. and then went to bed. 8 p.m., Julia Venturni, who lives at 1 Miller's Court, goes to bed. I just find it funny how they know what time these people went to bed or why they're even asking.
Right, they are so detailed. Know. And I like, when I laughed, it was a strange thing too. It's like, because they were talking about whist, which the only reason I know what whist is because of Around the World in 80 Days, where Phineas Fogg, the main character, who's British, plays whist. So that's like my experience with whist.
What is whist?
A card game.
Oh, okay.
Which was apparently very loved in England. Might still be.
Card games, I think, are fun anytime, except I don't like playing with you because you beat me like the last time and I didn't enjoy that at all.
It's weird though how, like, I feel like there are definitely regional card games, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
me being from like Northeast Ohio, everyone played euchre, but like over here, you have to teach people how to play euchre or you can't play euchre because no one knows what it is. And I feel like whist was kind of England.
Yeah, because I'm from Tennessee and I had no idea what the hell euchre was until I moved up to Ohio. And yeah. We played spades and speed solitaire.
Yeah.
And Egyptian rat screw, like euchre, that's my game.
But when you really love euchre, spades is like the euchre for people who don't care about strategy or fun. It's like dumbed down euchre.
That's just rude.
That's just how I feel in my heart. I'm very much a euchre elitist.
I don't have the patience. I think I have too much ADD to play those strategy games. Because like in chess, I'm just like, I'm just going to move here. Can you hurry up and move? You know, I can't. Yeah. Oh, I hate waiting. I can't do it.
My issues with chess is I'll have like a lucky win and I'll be like, I know the basic rules, of course, but as far as strategy, I'm like, I've got this. I'm starting to get good. And then mm-hmm. the next game, I'll get absolutely destroyed where it's like, man, I can't see one move ahead of myself.
Yeah.
So very hit or miss.
I could probably be pretty good at it if I could get my mind to just stay in the present moment and stop trying to, you know, go find something else to do.
Yeah. Or if you could see the chessboard on the ceiling, like the chick in the Queen's Gambit. If you haven't seen Queen's Gambit, watch Queen's Gambit. This is a Queen's Gambit plug.
I haven't seen it, but now I'm curious. Okay.
Very good.
On anyway. Netflix, right?
Yes, Netflix.
Wow, we totally got off on this. Okay. So Julia has now gone to bed. There are no confirmed sightings of Mary Jane Kelly between 8 p.m. and 11:45 p.m. There is an unconfirmed story that she's drinking with a woman named Elizabeth Foster at the Ten Bells Public House. 11 p.m. It's said that she is in the Britannia drinking with a young man with a dark mustache who appears respectable and well-dressed, and it's said that she's very drunk. Well, that's not really a stretch considering she's an alcoholic. 11:45 p.m., Marianne Cox, a 31-year-old widower and prostitute who lives at 5 Miller's Court, enters Dorset Street from Commercial Street. Cox is returning home to warm herself as the night had gotten really cold. She sees Kelly ahead of her walking with a stout man. The man was aged around 35 or 36 and about 5 feet tall. He was 5'5" tall. He was shabbily dressed in a long overcoat and a billycock hat. Here's a hat. He had a blotchy face and small side whiskers and a carroty mustache. I'm assuming that means he's a ginger.
British. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Right. Which this description very much we've heard before multiple times, right? Now that they've been seen with someone who was shorter. 5'5" mm-hmm. and the age range in the 30s, right? And the carroty, the ginger mustache, so, and the fact that I think before it said, like I said, shabby genteel, which would be a little bit more sophisticated, but the shabby coat, we've definitely heard, you know, the description as being more shabby.
Yeah. And he's got the billycock hat.
Right? Because we've talked about how we feel like the person would have means, right? They would have more money.
Yeah.
However, if you were smart, which the Ripper clearly was by eluding the police forever.
Right.
If you're going to commit a murder, why wouldn't you just get some like secondhand coat, throw it on? Because you're going to get blood on it. You want to fit into the area. You don't want to look like, ooh, the rich guy walking down the street, because now you're spotted, you're a target.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, an old trashy coat, who cares if it gets thrown away or whatever the hell he does.
Right. I mean, he could commit a murder and throw the coat right in the dumpster as he walks by. I mean,
or hell, just pitch it in the Thames. I mean, that's what everybody did anyway.
Right. I would say there probably aren't dumpsters all around like there are now.
No. Yeah. I don't think they had dumpsters back then. That's what the Thames was for, apparently, from what I understand. So Mrs. Cox follows them into Miller's court, and they're standing outside Kelly's room as Mrs. Cox passed and said goodnight. Somewhat incoherently, Kelly replied, "Goodnight, I'm going to sing." A few minutes later, Mrs. Cox hears Kelly sing in a violet from Mother's grave. Cox goes out again at midnight and hears Kelly singing the same song. Okay. So I'm assuming she's still with the dude that she was with, singing away.
Yeah, when she gets drunk, she just sings for 15 minutes straight, no biggie.
I guess so. Isn't that what you do? No, I'm just kidding. somewhere in this time period, Mary Jane takes a meal of fish and potatoes.
Oh, wow. Again, with the we've talked about the food details before.
I know.
Like, some, and we don't eat, like, this is the really weird thing about this statement. Somewhere in this time period. So now we're like vague.
Yeah.
So vague to super specific, all in one jump. Somewhere we don't know exactly when she had fish and potatoes. But you know what?
Yeah.
Maybe it's because of the autopsy. They always say what's in the belly.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that's true. Good catch. 12:30 a.m., Catherine Pickett, a flower seller who lives near Kelly, is disturbed by Kelly's singing. Pickett's husband stops her from going downstairs to complain. You leave the poor woman alone.
By the way, she started singing at 11:45. She's now been singing for 45 minutes.
Hey, she likes her tunes, man. At 1 a.m., it's beginning to rain. Again, Marianne Cox returns home to warm herself. At that time, Kelly is still singing, or has begun to sing again. There was light coming from Kelly's room. Shortly after 1, Cox goes out again. Man, Cox is on a mission. I mean, she's already got a room. Yeah. That's interesting.
And apparently, back before, like, radios and stereos and NEOs, you just sing in your room.
Apparently. Or go out and have sex with men for money.
Or both, like, at the same
Marianne
time.
Marianne Cox is doing. Exactly. You do both at the same time. Maybe get a bigger tip. Elizabeth Prater, the wife of William Prater, a boot finisher who had left her 5 years before, is standing at the entrance to Miller's Court waiting for a man. Prater lives in room number 20 of 26 Dorset Street, and this is directly above Kelly. She stands there about half an hour, then goes into McCarthy's to chat. She hears no singing and sees no one go in or out of the court. After a few minutes, she goes back to her room, places two chairs in front of her door, and goes to sleep without undressing. She is very drunk. There's a shocker. 2 a.m., George Hutchinson, a resident of the Victoria Working Men's Home on Commercial Street, has just returned to the area from Romford. He's walking Commercial Street and passes a man at the corner of Thrall Street, but pays no attention to him. Oh, dude, he probably just passed Jack the Ripper. Yeah. Didn't even know it. At Flower and Dean Street, he meets Kelly, who asks him for money. "Mr. Hutchinson, can you lend me sixpence?" "I can't," says Hutchinson. "I spent all my money going down to Romford." "Good morning," Kelly replies. "I must go and find some money." She then walks in the direction of Thrall Street. Okay, so now she's looking to score. So I'm guessing the dude that she was with originally is no longer with her, or got frightened off by her singing. Because there's no mention of him.
Yeah.
She meets the man. Hutchinson had passed earlier. The man puts his hand on Kelly's shoulder and says something at which Kelly and the man laugh. Hutchinson hears Kelly say, "All right," and the man say, "You will be all right for what I have told you." The man then puts his right hand on Kelly's shoulder and they begin to walk towards Dorset Street. Hutchinson notices the man has a small parcel in his left hand. Oh.
This is our second parcel, right?
It's the second parcel.
And it was small. It was.
Yes, what? It was. 6 by 18. Yeah, a really weird shape. While standing under a streetlight outside the Queen's Head Public House, Hutchinson gets a good look at the man with Mary Jane Kelly. He has a pale complexion, a slight mustache turned up at the corners, changed to dark complexion and heavy mustache in the press reports, dark hair, dark eyes, and bushy eyebrows. He is, according to Hutchinson, of Jewish appearance. The man is wearing a soft felt hat pulled down over his eyes, a long dark coat trimmed in astrakhan, a white collar with a black necktie fixed with a horseshoe pin. He wears dark spats over light button over boots. A massive gold chain is in his waistcoat with a large seal with a red stone hanging from it. He carries kid gloves in his right hand and a small package in his left. He is 5'6 or 5'7 tall and about 35 or 36 years old. That is, this dude's remarkably well-versed in observing things, because that's a lot of very specific items that this dude has on him.
Yes. And keep in mind that he had already passed this guy and said he didn't even like notice him at all. Right. Mm-hmm. Now, Mary Kelly says one sentence to him. The guy turns around and like knows everything about the dude.
Yeah.
Right. And I wonder also about the Jewish appearance, right? Because they're talking about how they changed her initial description. This is a description from the woman, right?
No, this is Hutchinson.
This is from Hutchinson. Yeah. The original description, though, he said he was of slight complexion with a pale mustache, but that the reports reported it as a dark mustache and dark complexion, right? So they completely changed it. So I'm wondering if when they talk about the Jewish appearance, it's not just the newspapers and stuff again trying to pinpoint someone that's Jewish because of the anti-Semitism that went on during that time period.
Well, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me given the fact that, you know, his deposition to the police and the reports that were in the paper were completely contrasting.
Right, because he said that this was someone of pale complexion with a pale mustache, which would very much not be someone who's Jewish.
No, not well. I mean,
necessarily.
If we're going by stereotype, I guess.
Right.
Be able to say that.
Right, but now all of a sudden the press reports say dark mustache, dark complexion, which isn't what the guy said at all, and looks Jewish.
Yeah, I mean, I would not be surprised at all if this is more anti-Semitic rant by the
media. Yeah, seems like it.
Yeah, which is really sad. What
the kids' gloves are for?
I don't know. Because obviously if they're kid gloves, you can't. All right, kid gloves, is that like a saying for? I don't think it actually means kid gloves. Isn't it something for?
If it's maybe a style of glove?
Yeah. I don't know. I'll have to look that up.
Because you know the phrase, which I think is what you were alluding to right there, like handles, like if you say you handle someone with kid gloves, take it easy on them. So I'm wondering if it's not just like a thin pair of gloves, like a driving glove or some sort of more sophisticated glove, like maybe the white gloves.
Like something you would use, to put on if you're touching some kind of art piece that could be damaged by your finger oils. Yeah,
that would make more sense anyways, because I don't think Hutchinson could turn around and be like, oh, he's got a toddler's gloves in his hands. You know what I mean?
I don't know. He seemed to see everything else the guy was wearing. Yeah, so sure. Who knows? Oh, my gosh. But yeah,
he definitely sounds more sophisticated from this description. We got the massive gold chain, right? The waistcoat. We've got these special gloves.
Yeah, most definitely. So Kelly and the man cross Commercial Street and turn down Dorset Street. Hutchinson follows them. Kelly and the man stop outside Miller's Court and talk for about 3 minutes, and Kelly's heard to say, all right, my dear, come along. You'll be comfortable. The man puts his arm around Kelly, who kisses him. I've lost my handkerchief, she says. At this, he hands her a red handkerchief. The couple then heads down Miller's Court. Hutchinson waits until the clock strikes 3 a.m., leaving as the clock strikes the hour. I wonder why he was following her to begin with. Interesting.
Yeah.
3 a.m. Mrs. Cox returns home yet again. It's raining hard and there's no sound or light coming from Kelly's room. Cox does not go back out, but does not go to sleep. Throughout the night, she occasionally hears men going in and out of the court. She told the inquest, I heard someone go out at 5:45. I do not know what house he went out of, as I heard no door shut. 4 a.m. Elizabeth Prater is awakened by her pet kitten Diddles. Aww. Walking on her neck. She hears a faint cry of, oh, murder, but as the cry of murder is common in the district, she pays no attention to it. Now, that's just sad. If somebody screams, oh, murder outside my house, I'm getting my gun and going out and looking, seeing what the hell is going on. God. And they even know the name of the pet kitten Diddles. This is so just I love this stuff. It's just great. I'm not sure I'd name my cat Diddles, but okay. As I said, she paid no attention to it. Sarah Lewis, who's staying with friends in Miller's Court, also hears a cry. Apparently, she didn't do anything either. Because now we're jumping ahead to 8:30 a.m., 4.5 hours later. Carolyn Maxwell, a witness of the inquest and acquaintance of Kelly's, claims to have seen the deceased at around 8:30 a.m., several hours after the time given by Phillips as time of death. She described her clothing and appearance in depth and adamantly stated that she was not mistaken about the date, although she admitted she did not know Kelly very well. So I wonder who's screaming murder, especially this is what kind of confuses me. So we've got all these police constables walking all over the area because of the Jack Ripper and everything. Someone cries murder at 4 a.m. and it's still 8:30. No one
reported it, right?
Yeah.
For hours and hours.
Yeah. You would think that the cops would have come rushing in.
Right. And if the suspect leave, when they said they saw, heard someone leaving at six, if that was Jack the Ripper, right? You've still got hours after him leaving.
Yeah.
That no one's reporting anything, but someone's called murder 2 hours prior.
So weird.
Yeah.
Now, at 10 a.m., Maurice Lewis, a tailor who resided in Dorset Street, told newspapers he had seen Kelly and Barnett in the Horn of Plenty public house on the night of the murder, but more importantly, that he saw her about 10 a.m. the next day. Like Maxwell, this time is several hours from the time of death, and because of this discrepancy, he was not called to the inquest and virtually ignored by the police. Well, that is probably the smartest thing they've done, is ignore this dude.
Okay, here's a question for you. She always had prostitutes staying with her. Multiple people now have seen her after her apparent death.
Mm-hmm.
Forensics were shitty.
Right.
Do we know that Mary Jane Kelly was killed?
Well, if you look at those pictures.
I'm saying it could have been a different prostitute.
I know. Yeah. I mean, it's possible. Like,
well, yeah. I see what you're saying. Looking at the pictures, she's so mutilated. How would you know who that is? But she would have to be like faking her own death because she clearly disappears, right? So, but it's just very, very weird to me that two people see her pass way past. I mean, 10 o'clock a.m., she would have died at like 4. That's like 6 hours prior.
Right. Well, I think it's just this Lewis guy who told that she was seen hours later. Well,
no, because
no, the 8:30. Yeah, no, the lady said
also two people saw her hours after her death. Unless she's resurrected,
or maybe these people are just drunk at 8:30 in the morning and 10 a.m. and think they see her.
I mean, or, it's possible. It's just very odd that two of them.
Well, that's true. But, I mean, Jack the Ripper's high-profile case, and maybe these people are just wanting to get their 15 minutes of fame.
Maybe, like, but
she didn't die at 4 a.m. Like, I went and had breakfast with her.
Right, but the Carolyn Maxwell described her outfit to a T and was very adamant.
True.
I don't, but, you know. Very, I mean, I'm not saying, I'm just throwing out the thought. She's got all these different
Prostitutes I mean, it's,
in her apartment all the time, right? So, it's just very weird.
True. But I don't know. I mean, all these people seem to be really nosy all the time, except for when somebody cries murder.
Right.
Apparently. Yeah. So there hasn't been anybody coming out and saying, okay, well, she had such and such person staying in her room with her. Unless, you know, like you said, it wasn't actually her who came back to the room. You know, maybe she was, I don't know, off somewhere else. But I mean, if that wasn't her that was killed, then she completely disappeared because there's been no mention of her ever since.
Which, in all honesty, if someone's brutally murdered to this extent in your place of residence, I could see being like, I'm never going back there again. But I would go tell the police, hey, I'm still alive. I don't know who that is, but I'm never going back there again.
Unless she took the opportunity to start a completely brand new life. Well, Mary Jane Kelly's dead, so I'm going to make up a new identity for myself and go live in Ireland.
Yeah. I mean, like, we're clearly speculating, but it's just very, very odd that at 8:30 and 10 o'clock, two different people saw her and she's died hours prior.
Yeah. True. Now, at 10:45 a.m., John McCarthy, owner of McCarthy's Rents, as Miller's Court was known, sends Thomas Bowyer to collect past due rent money from Mary Kelly. After Bowyer receives no response from knocking, and because the door was locked, he pushes aside the curtain and peers inside, seeing the body. He informs McCarthy, who, after seeing the mutilated remains of Kelly for himself, ran to Commercial Street Police Station, where he spoke with Inspector Walter Beck, who returned to the court with McCarthy. Several hours later, after waiting fruitlessly for the arrival of the bloodhounds, Barnaby and Burgo, McCarthy smashes in the door with an axe handle under orders from Superintendent Thomas Arnold. Very Why would you need bloodhounds?
I don't
right,
know. But
right then.
I don't know. Because, like, isn't their job just to find blood? It's clearly everywhere.
Right.
But I just think it's really interesting that we've got Diddles, we've got Barnaby, we've got Burgo.
Well, Barnaby and Burgo probably
knowing every animal's name.
Well, they were probably in reports, you know, because they are police. So that part, I believe the Diddles maybe not so much.
Diddles might have been in a report too, though. That's her description. True. She's like, I was with Diddles, and this is what happened.
That's very true. It's very possible. Oh Lord! Now, when the police enter the room, they find Mary Jane Kelly's clothes neatly folded on a chair, and she's wearing a chemist's. Her boots are in front of the fireplace. All right, kids, now we're getting into the post-mortem, so this is when shit gets real. All right. Dr. Thomas Bond, a distinguished police surgeon from A Division, was called in on the Mary Kelly murder. His report is as follows. The body was lying naked in the middle of the bed, the shoulders flat, but the axis of the body inclined to the left side of the bed. The head was turned on the left cheek. The left arm was close to the body with the forearm flexed at a right angle and lying across the abdomen. The right arm was slightly abducted from the body and rested on the mattress. The elbow was bent, the forearm supine with the fingers clenched. The legs were wide apart, the left thigh at right angles to the trunk and the right forming an obtuse angle with the pubes. The whole of the surface of the abdomen and thighs were removed and the abdominal cavity emptied of its viscera. The breasts were cut off, the arms mutilated by several jagged wounds and the face hacked beyond recognition of the features. The tissues of the neck were severed all round down to the bone. The viscera
beyond recognition.
Yeah. Yeah. The viscera were found in various parts, the uterus and kidneys with one breast under the head, the other breast by the right foot, the liver between the feet, the intestines by the right side, and the spleen by the left side of the body. The flaps removed from the abdomen and thighs were on a table. So clearly he was not looking to sell any of her parts. He's just fucking ripping her apart. God. And imagine if he's doing this with nothing but a scalpel. I mean, very, very sharp instrument, yes, but also very, very small. I mean, it's not something that you could like just really hack shit off quickly. God, he took his time. He had to have. And he would have had to been saturated with blood. The bed clothing at the right corner was saturated with blood, and on the floor beneath was a pool of blood covering about 2 feet square. The wall by the right side of the bed and in a line with the neck was marked by blood, which had struck it in a number of separate places, splashes. Okay, so we've got arterial spurt. Yeah. So he killed her while he slashed while she was alive. He had to have. Right? Are we in agreement with that?
Yes.
Okay.
But I'm wondering if he did something to restrict her screaming. And clearly the neighbors would have heard.
Well, if he cut so hard her throat and cut her vocal cords, there's no way she would have been able to scream.
Yeah. So if the first thing, if it just seemed like a normal prostitution situation and then he just out of nowhere just deep slashes.
Yeah. Or maybe she did scream, but that may have been the time that her upstairs neighbor was out doing whatever she was doing, hadn't been home at the time to hear anything. Mm-mm. The face was gashed in all directions, the nose, cheeks, eyebrows, and ears being partly removed. The lips were blanched and cut by several incisions running obliquely down to the chin. There were also numerous cuts extending irregularly across all the features. The neck was cut through the skin and other tissues right down to the vertebrae. Oh, yeah. The fifth and sixth being deeply notched. The skin cuts in the front of the neck show distinct ecchymosis. The air passage was cut at the lower part of the larynx through the cricoid cartilage. Oh, man, he slashed her hard on the throat. Both breasts were more or less removed by circular incisions, the muscle down to the ribs being attached to the breasts. The intercostals between the fourth, fifth, and sixth ribs were cut through, and the contents of the thorax visible through the openings. God, that's intense. Just that. That's just intense. The skin and tissues of the abdomen from the costal arch to the pubes were removed in three large flaps. The right thigh was denuded in front to the bone, the flap of skin, including the external organs of generation and part of the right buttock. The left thigh was stripped of skin fascia, the muscles as far as the knee. He filleted her on parts. The left calf showed a long gash through skin and tissues to deep muscles and reaching from the knee to 5 inches above the ankle. Both arms and forearms had extensive jagged wounds. The right thumb showed a small superficial incision about 1 inch long with extravasation, of blood in the skin. And there were several abrasions on the back of the hand, moreover showing the same condition. On opening the thorax, it was found that the right lung was minimally adherent by old firm adhesions. The lower part of the lung was broken and torn away. The left lung was intact. It was adherent at the apex, and there were a few adhesions over the side. In the substances of the lung, there were several nodules of consolidation. The pericardium was open below and the heart absent. In the abdominal cavity, there was some partly digestive food of fish and potatoes. There you go.
Potatoes.
And similar food was found in the remains of the stomach attached to the intestines. God, he cut his stomach. You know, looking at the pictures, yes, they're gruesome, but they don't show any of this, really. I mean, it just looks like he was ripping and slashing, but he did so much more.
Right.
Dr. George Baxter Phillips was also present at the scene and gave the following testimony at the inquest. The mutilated remains of a female were lying two-thirds over towards the edge of the bedstead nearest the door. She had only her chemise on or some underlinen garment. I am sure that the body had been removed subsequent to the injury which caused her death from that side of the bedstead that was nearest the wooden partition because of the large quantity of blood under the bedstead and the saturated condition of the sheet and at the palliasse at the corner nearest the partition. The blood was produced by the severance of the carotid artery, which was the cause of death. The injury was inflicted while the deceased was lying at the right side of the bedstead. Man.
I don't understand at all how they identify the bodies. Like, they wouldn't, back then, teeth wouldn't even have been a thing, right? As far as.
No.
I've got a brush up. Obviously, we're gonna get into all of the conspiracies, etc. But I feel like in the royal family conspiracy, one of the theories is that it's not really Mary Jane Kelly that died, and that she was taken. And it's like just looking at the two people that said they saw her after she died, and then the amount of mutilation where they said an unrecognizable face and the whole body's destroyed, right?
Right.
How do they even determine who this person is with no forensics?
The only thing I can think of is that it's because Marianne Kelly was the one who was staying in that room.
Right. They just assumed this is her place, but we've already got multiple statements of she let whoever wanted to stay there at any point, stay there at any point. Right. So if she's got prostitutes living with her, I'm sure she's also probably given them permission. If you want to bring a person back here, just make sure they're out before I get home, you know, type of thing.
Yeah. Cause I mean, just looking at the pictures, it may have been different in person, you know, cause I mean, I don't, well, I mean, you really can't see much of her face, though, can you? I mean, it's,
no,
it's...
but they did say that it was beyond recognition.
Yeah.
No, I'm not saying it's not her. I'm just saying that, like, I would have serious issues as a police officer even, like, making an identification, which I feel like even in the Baxter Phillips autopsy, he's not necessarily making... I mean, it's scientific talk, but he says the female, yeah. Right? He doesn't right. say... He doesn't at any point claim to know who this is. This is just a female that's mutilated.
Yeah, I mean, it's... I don't know. I mean, it very well may not have been her.
It's just interesting.
And unfortunately, I mean, she was, you know, she had a funeral. She was buried November 19th, 1888, in a public grave at St. Patrick's Roman Catholic Cemetery. The funeral of the murdered woman Kelly has once more been postponed. Deceased was a Catholic, and the man Barnett, with whom she lived, and her landlord, Mr. McCarthy, desired to see her remains interred with the ritual of her church. The funeral will therefore take place tomorrow, the 19th of November, in the Roman Catholic Cemetery at Leytonstone. The hearse will leave the Shoreditch mortuary at 12:30. No family member could be found to attend the funeral, and Mary Jane's grave was reclaimed in the 1950s. John Morrison erected a large white headstone in 1986, but marked the wrong grave. Morrison's headstone was later removed, and the superintendent remarked Mary Jane's grave with a simple memorial in the 1990s. So none of her family were there to obviously identify. So, I mean, it's very possible.
I was going to say, too, it's like all the other victims, like ex-husband or father, or there was always someone that was listed as identifying the body. We've got no one even... They haven't even mentioned anyone identifying this body.
Yeah, I mean, did Barnett even... I wonder if Barnett was even called in to say, hey, can you... I know it's awful, but can you see if this might be her?
Right.
I mean, what if that's... what if she lived a long, happy life in Ireland?
Yeah.
And this is some poor other unknown.
Yeah. I mean, if you're someone's lover, like Barnett would have been with her,
mm-hmm.
even without the face, you would be able to recognize something about... I mean, maybe not after this crime, but you would think there would be something you would recognize, right? So, mm-hmm. but there's just no mention of anyone IDing the body. So that's just another interesting factor, I think.
All right, Ben, we're going to throw out another theory. She wasn't actually killed, and she lived a long, happy life in Ireland.
Still alive.
Still alive. Yeah, she's still alive today. She does tours. I don't know. There's so many what ifs and could be's and all this other stuff with this whole yeah. case, with all of them and with Jack right. especially.
I mean, like you said, too, we got two people that saw her after death, but we're also talking about a time period where everyone seems to be drunk. And I don't know why nobody sleeps at night, because at 4 a.m. I wouldn't be like giving any details. I go to bed at 8.
Right. But you know, 4 a.m. you're probably just waking up, so you're half dead to the world anyway.
Yeah, I definitely wouldn't be like, oh, saw this guy. No, I didn't. I was in bed.
I'd be like, officer, I was just going to the bathroom and somebody yelled murder and I went back to bed, so I don't know. That would not happen.
That could have been a coincidence. The lady said people scream murder there all the time, so maybe that might not have had anything to do with anything, but it also has a good possibility that it did.
Funny to me.
Right. That's a normal thing. But like, if she saw someone, like, you would figure she wasn't actually in Mary Kelly's apartment. So I would assume she would have screamed murder because she saw some dude leaving covered in blood. Right.
Yeah. Because, you know, he had to be covered in blood. Like, right. Oh, my God.
But then, why the hell are people seeing her 4 and 6 hours later?
Oh, Lord. Can you imagine? Well, I mean, Jack didn't really pick his victims based on who they were, so.
Right.
Oh, God. Yeah, it's. I mean, unless the two people who, quote unquote, saw her after she apparently died. Maybe it was her ghost. We're paranormal people. Let's throw that option in there, too.
I mean, it could have been, right? Like.
You never know.
I mean, I think you and I are both in the agreement that more likely to be a ghost if you die in some tragic way, right?
True. And I can't think of any other more tragic way than that.
Right.
Well, I can, but we're not going to go there. We'll keep my dark spaces down.
All right, guys, thank you for joining us for the final victim installment of our Jack the Ripper series for Through the Abyss podcast. Join us next week when we will start getting into some of the theories and suspects and continue on. I am Ben.
I'm Mandy, and I'm super excited for next week and probably the 6 weeks following that because there's so much information. And as always, if you like us, please give us a thumbs up and subscribe and pass us along to your friends and share and all that fun stuff because it does help us gain more listeners. And to all of our European people, we love you so much. Thank you so much for tuning in. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in to us. And we will see you next week.
Bye.
Well, Ben, we got another episode under our belts. Thanks so much for tuning in to Through the Abyss podcast. And until next time, keep it weird.
Spooky stuff.